She had married him, and indeed been crowned with him, in the presence of the greatest and most learned churchmen of both England and Spain, and for the past 18 years no one had voiced any doubts. If he had simply been honest with her, telling her that he had fears for the succession, and felt that he must remarry to engender a son, she would at least have understood, even though her answer might have been the same. So far as she was concerned, she was the legal wife of her husband and the rightful Queen of England, and would continue so to be until she died. As to where she would like to go, she had every intention of remaining where she was. If she was obliged to move, she would choose to go to the Tower. Then at least the people of England would know what had become of her, and would offer up their prayers on her behalf. In any case, there could be no question of an annulment. As she wrote to her nephew the Emperor, "For the present, Pope, to undo what his predecessors have done, would reflect on his honour and conscience, and bring grave discredit to the Apostolic See, which should stand firmly on the rock which is Christ. Were the Pope to waver now, in this case, many might be led astray into thinking that right and justice are not with him." Catherine of Aragon was a woman of steel. She might bend to her husband, as far as her sense of duty required, but she would never break. The League of Cognac had failed catastrophically to drive the imperialists out of Italy, but Charles had been unable to pay the soldiers who had fought so successfully against it. The result was that some 34,000 deeply discontented men went on the rampage, out to plunder the richest city they could find, and that city was Rome. Early in 1527 the army under the command of the Duke of Bourbon, who had had little choice in the matter, advanced on the Papal States. Despite his treachery to his king, Bourbon remained a charismatic figure, universally admired for his courage. He never shirked an engagement and could always be found where the fighting was thickest. He was also immediately distinguishable by the silver and white surcoat that he always wore, and by his black, white and yellow standard emblazoned with the word Espérance. Ignoring the several important towns along his route, he led the army directly to Rome, drawing it up on the Janiculum Hill, immediately to the north of the city wall, and at 4 o'clock in the morning of 6th of May 1527 the attack began. In the absence of heavy artillery, Bourbon had decided that the walls would have to be scaled, a technique far more difficult and dangerous than that of simply pounding them till they crumbled. He himself was one of the first of the casualties. He was actually positioning a scaling ladder against the wall when he was shot through the chest by an enemy arquebus, fired, if we are to accept the man's own testimony, by Benvenuto Cellini himself. Thirst for revenge spurred on his men, and soon after, 6 in the morning, the imperial army, now commanded by Philibert of Chalons, Prince of Orange, burst into the city. The Romans rushed from the wall to barricade their homes, and many of the papal troops joined the enemy to save their own skins. Only the Pope's personal Swiss guard fought heroically on until it was slaughtered en masse on the steps of St. Peter's. As the invaders approached the Vatican, the Pope was hustled out of his apartments and led along the Passetto di Borgo, the covered way that still links the Vatican City to the Castel Sant'Angelo, which was already thronged with panic-stricken families seeking refuge. Such were the crowds that it was only with the greatest difficulty that the portcullis could be lowered. One cardinal had to be pushed in through a window. Another was pulled up in a basket. Outside, in the Borgo and Trastevere, despite the specific orders by their commanders, the imperial army, hungry and unpaid, embarked on an orgy of killing. Cardinal Giovanni Maria Chiocci del Monte, the future Pope Julius III, was hung up by his hair. Almost all the patients in the hospital of Santo Spirito were massacred. Of the orphans of the Pietà, not one was left alive. Just before midnight the invaders crossed the Tiber. The sack that followed has been described as one of the most horrible in recorded history. The bloodbath continued unabated. To venture out into the street was to invite almost certain death, and to remain indoors was very little safer. Scarcely a single church, palace or house of any size escaped pillage and devastation. Monasteries were plundered and convents violated, the more attractive nuns being offered for sale in the streets. The Vatican Library was saved only because Philibert had established his headquarters there. At least two of the cardinals who had failed to escape to the Castel Sant'Angelo were dragged through the city and tortured. One of them, who was well over 80, subsequently died from his injuries. Hell, reported a Venetian eyewitness, has nothing to compare with the present state of Rome. Not till the 10th of May, with the arrival of Cardinal Pompeo Colonna, a sworn enemy of Pope Clement, and his two brothers with 8,000 of their men, was a semblance of order restored. By this time, virtually every street in the city had been gutted and was strewn with corpses. One captured Spanish sapper later reported that on the north bank of the Tiber alone, he and his companions had buried nearly 10,000 and had thrown another 2,000 into the river. 6 months later, thanks to widespread starvation and an epidemic of plague, due probably to the thousands of bodies lying unburied during the hottest season of the year, the population of Rome had been reduced to less than half of what it had been before the siege. Culturally, too, the loss was incalculable. Paintings, sculptures, and libraries were ravaged and destroyed. The pontifical archives ransacked. The painter Parmigianino was imprisoned, saving his life only by making drawings of his jailers. And Pope Clement remained in the Castel Sant'Angelo, a prisoner of the imperialists. It was during his half-year's captivity that Clement grew a bushy black beard, as a sign of mourning for the sack of Rome. Heretofore, Catholic canon law had required priests to be clean-shaven, but Clement's example was followed by his successor, Paul III, and by the 24 popes who followed him, right down to Innocent XII, who died in 1700. Far away in Spain, the emperor had no idea of what had happened in his name until it was over. He was naturally appalled, but there was nothing he could do. It was now that Wolsey saw his opportunity. By this time, his thoughts, like Henry's, were dominated by what was always referred to as the king's great matter. He knew that Clement was unlikely, to put it mildly, to confirm the annulment of the queen's marriage while he was effectively the prisoner of her favourite nephew. Consequently, if such confirmation were ever to be granted, it would have to be while the Pope was still in the Castel Sant'Angelo. On the 22nd of July, he took ship for France. His plan was ambitious, to say the least. He would meet a group of favourably minded cardinals in Avignon, take advantage of the Pope's incarceration to seize control of the church administration, and then rush through an official approval to the king's annulment and remarriage. He even drew up a commission, to be signed by Clement, granting to himself absolute power even to relax, limit, or moderate divine law. But Clement, though still in captivity, was apparently able to retain at least a degree of control. Sensing danger, he had forbidden any of his cardinals to move from the Vatican. Wolsey heard the news before he had got further than Compiègne. But the frustration he doubtless felt can have been as nothing to his alarm when he found one of the king's secretaries, William Knight, on his way to Rome with a letter from Henry to the Pope. This sought nothing less than a dispensation for the king to marry again, even if his marriage to Catherine were not annulled. A license, in fact, for bigamy. It was a foolish enough request, but for the cardinal it carried a yet more sinister message. It had been sent without his knowledge or approval. Henry, it seemed, was taking policy into his own hands. Wolsey managed to stop the letter, but a day or two later it was followed by another with a further proposal. If his first marriage were annulled, the king requested that he be permitted to marry any woman, even if she were related to him in the first degree of affinity, even one whose affinity sprang from illicit intercourse, and even one with whom he himself had had intercourse already. It was in many ways a remarkable document, strongly implying, as it did, the king's intention to marry Anne Boleyn and implicitly confessing his affair with her sister. It had, of course, no effect, but it struck further terror into Wolsey's heart. Even in matters of the greatest moment, Henry was no longer taking his advice. His fears grew even greater when, hurrying back to London, he found the king closeted with Anne. Now, for the first time, he found himself debarred from his sovereign, who refused absolutely to receive him until his mistress allowed him permission to do so. Peace between France and the Empire, when it was finally concluded, was the result of negotiations begun during the winter of 1528-9 between Francis's mother, Louise of Savoy, and her sister-in-law, and the Emperor's aunt, Margaret of Austria. The two met in Cambrai on the 5th of July 1529, and the resulting treaty was signed in the first week of August. The Ladies' Peace, as it came to be called, was a surprisingly long and complicated document, but it confirmed imperial rule in Italy. Francis renounced all his claims to Milan, Genoa, and Naples, for which he and his predecessors had fought so hard for the best part of 40 years. Charles, for his part, ransomed the king's sons after all, though demanding no less than 1,000,000 ducats. They finally returned on the 1st of July 1530, and promised not to press his claims to Burgundy, Provence, and Languedoc. For Francis himself, and for his allies in the League of Cognac, who had not been consulted during the negotiations and felt that he had betrayed them, it was a sad and shameful settlement. But at least it brought peace to Italy, and put an end to that long and unedifying chapter in her history, a chapter that had brought the Italians nothing but devastation and destruction. The imperial army had suffered almost as much as the Romans. It too was virtually without food. Its soldiers, unpaid for months, were totally demoralized, interested only in loot and pillage. Discipline had broken down. Germans and Spaniards were at each other's throats. Pope Clement, however, had no course open to him but once again to capitulate. The official price he paid was the cities of Ostia, Civitavecchia, Piacenza and Modena, together with 400,000 ducats, a sum that could be raised only by melting down all the papal tiaras and selling the jewels with which they were encrusted. The papal states, in which an efficient government had been developing for the first time in history, had crumbled away. Clement himself had escaped from the Castel Sant'Angelo in early December 1527. Rome was still uninhabitable, so the unhappy pope, disguised as a poor peddler, struggled off with a few cardinals to Orvieto, where he settled as best he could in the draughty, dilapidated, and bitterly cold palace of the local bishop. It was there that he received ambassadors from King Henry. One of them reported, "The pope lieth in an old palace of the bishops of the city, ruinous and decayed. As we came to his privy chamber, we passed three chambers, all naked and unhanged, the roofs fallen down, and as one can guess, 30 persons, riff-raff and others, standing in the chambers for a garnishment. And as for the Pope's bedchamber, all the apparel in it was not worth 20 nobles. It were better to be in captivity in Rome than here at liberty." Here was an opportunity to repair at least some of the papal finances. Clement had but to agree to the King of England's annulment. Henry would be only too happy to pay liberally for it. But still the Pope havered. Decisions were always difficult for him, but this one was harder than most because, quite apart from political considerations, he was afraid. Afraid of the Emperor and his loathsome Landsknechte, who had already wrought havoc once in the Holy City, and would be only too pleased, if given the opportunity, to repeat the process. Finally, the English ambassadors produced a draft that went nowhere near far enough, but they felt was the most that the Pope might possibly accept. The cardinals fell on it as though there were a scorpion under every word. The resulting document, still further emasculated, was sealed on the 13th of April, 1528. The ambassadors warned Clement that there was no chance of their master accepting it, but the Pope replied that even this was a declaration against the Emperor, for which he fully expected to be punished. Charles, by contrast, found himself in an unusually strong position, strong enough to demand his imperial coronation. This was no longer the indispensable ceremony that it had been in former centuries. His grandfather, Maximilian, had ignored it altogether. He himself, since his first coronation at Aachen, had been nearly 10 years on the throne, deprived throughout that time of this final confirmation of his authority. The fact remained, nevertheless, that until the Pope had anointed him and laid the crown on his head, he was not technically Holy Roman Emperor. To one possessing so all-pervading a sense of divine mission, both title and sacrament were important. Imperial coronations were traditionally performed in Rome. On landing at Genoa in mid-August 1529, however, the Emperor received alarming news. Sultan Suleiman, at the head of a large army, was steadily advancing on Vienna. It was clear that in such circumstances a projected journey so far down the Italian peninsula would be folly. It would take far too long, as well as leaving him dangerously cut off in the event of a crisis. Messengers sped to Pope Clement, who agreed that, in the circumstances, the ceremony might be held in Bologna, a firmly papal city that remained considerably more accessible. Even then, the uncertainty was not over. While on his way to Bologna in September, Charles received an urgent appeal for help from his brother, Ferdinand, in Vienna, and came near to cancelling his coronation plans there and then. Only after long consideration did he decide not to do so. There was no point. By the time he reached Vienna, the city would have fallen, or the Sultan would have retired for the winter. In either case, the small force that he had with him in Italy would have been insufficient to tip the scales. And so, on the 5th of November, 1529, Charles V made his formal entry into Bologna, where, on the steps of the great basilica of San Petronio, Pope Clement was waiting to receive him. There was much to be done, many outstanding problems to be discussed and resolved before the coronation could take place. It was, after all, only 2 years since Papal Rome had been sacked by imperial troops, with Clement himself a virtual prisoner of Charles in the Castel Sant'Angelo. Somehow, friendly relations had to be re-established. Only when peace had been restored throughout the peninsula would Charles feel justified in kneeling before the Pope to receive the imperial crown. Coronation day was fixed for the 24th of February, 1530. Emperor and Pope had given themselves a little under 4 months to settle the future of Italy. It proved enough. Peace was signed. Clement's League of Cognac and Charles's sack of Rome were, if not forgotten, at least dismissed from mind, and on the day appointed, in San Petronio, Charles was first anointed and then received from the Pope's hands the sword, orb, sceptre, and finally the crown of the Holy Roman Empire. Something of a cloud was cast over the proceedings when a makeshift wooden bridge linking the church with the palace collapsed just as the Emperor's suite was passing across it. But once it was established that the many casualties included no one of serious importance, spirits quickly revived, and celebrations continued long into the night. It was the last time in history that a pope was to crown an emperor. On that day, the 700-year-old tradition, which had begun in AD 800, when Pope Leo III had laid the imperial crown on the head of Charlemagne, was brought to an end. The empire was by no means finished, but never again would it be received, even symbolically, from the hands of the Vicar of Christ on earth. Sultan Suleiman was riding high. After Mohaj, he had plundered Buda. He did not take possession of the city, but he destroyed the palace, which boasted a collection of Renaissance art as magnificent as anything in Italy, removing its superb library together with the collections of Matthias Corvinus, which were sent back to Istanbul. It was the first great victory of the Turks in the heartland of Latin Christendom. The question now was who was to rule in Hungary. King Louis had died without issue, and the way seemed clear for John Zápolya, who had been careful not to intervene at Mohács, to place himself under the Sultan's protection and to persuade Stephen Podmanitsky, the senior Hungarian bishop surviving after seven of his fellow prelates had been killed in the battle, to crown him king. When, however, on the 22nd of October 1526, Louis's brother-in-law, the Archduke Ferdinand, was elected, first as King of Bohemia and then as King of Hungary, Podmanitsky decided that Zápolya's coronation had been unwise. On the 17th of December, he crowned Ferdinand as well. The result was that there were now two kings of Hungary, one recognized by the Sultan, the other by the Emperor. The desire to destroy Ferdinand, and thus to reunite all Hungary under his domination, may have been an additional reason for the Sultan's decision to attack Vienna in 1529, but he would probably have done so in any case as part of his grand plan for the conquest of Eastern Europe. Vienna, Suleiman believed, was, despite its importance, surprisingly weakly defended and would soon be forced to submit. It lay only 90 miles from the Turkish frontier. The campaign promised to be relatively easy. Perhaps for this reason he seems to have been in no hurry, leaving Istanbul only in May and spending a fair time in Hungary, first for a formal meeting with John Zápolya and then for a successful attack on Buda, where the imperial troops surrendered within a week. As a result, the army took the road to Vienna far too late in the year and was further seriously delayed, as always, by the atrocious weather that continued throughout the summer. The heavy artillery was often immobilized for days at a time, axle-deep in mud. Many of the several thousand camels intended to pull them simply gave up the struggle and died. In consequence, the heaviest and most powerful cannon never arrived at all. The army arrived outside the city walls only on the 27th of September. Vast numbers of men were too sick or exhausted to function at all, far less to fight, but the Sultan, nothing daunted, pitched his camp and settled down to a siege. He was soon to find that the Viennese defences were a good deal stronger than he had thought. Within the city, the defenders, who had been aware for some time of the coming danger, had brought in various regiments of European mercenaries, including a regiment of Spanish musketeers and another of German Landsknecht, pikemen. Ferdinand himself was not present. He had preferred to remain in Linz, where he could organize further help if necessary, and keep in some degree of contact with his brother the Emperor. Overall command was therefore given to the 70-year-old German mercenary Count Nicholas of Salm, who had distinguished himself with extraordinary courage at Pavia. He now blocked the four gates to the city, strengthened the walls where necessary, and constructed a huge inner rampart. He was, in fact, encouraging the Sultan to do his worst. As was normal in Turkish siege warfare, the sappers set to work at once, digging a network of tunnels under the fortifications and laying mines at strategic points. But the defenders detected and detonated the mines almost as soon as they were laid. On the 6th of October, Sam dispatched a force of 800 men, which effectively put an end to sappers and tunnels alike, but was then followed by a disastrous attempt at a sortie. That evening, 500 Christian heads were piled up in celebration. Despite these minor triumphs, however, it gradually became clear to the Turks that the siege, if it continued, was going to be long and hard. Rain continued to fall, the wind grew colder, the sick soldiers grew sicker still, and ammunition and supplies were running short. Finally, the Janissaries, the Sultan's crack regiment on which he relied above all others, began to voice their impatience. In the middle of the month, unseasonably but inexorably, the rain turned to snow and the cold increased. Suleiman assembled all his available forces for one last desperate assault, and when that failed, he had no alternative but to lead his army home. In Vienna, the church bells rang, and great celebratory salvos were fired as the Ottoman army disappeared over the horizon. But its troubles were not yet over. It faced a long and terrible march back to the Bosphorus. Most of the artillery and much of the baggage was lost or abandoned, food was short, and many of the prisoners were to die on the journey. For the Sultan personally, the campaign had been a disaster. It was to mark not only the limit of his westward advance, but also, although he was not to know it, the turning of the tide and the beginning of the steady decline of the Ottoman Empire over the next four centuries. 4. Enough, my son. In its early years, Henry's marriage to Catherine of Aragon had been happy enough. It is perhaps unlikely that he felt the passion that was unquestionably, if briefly, aroused by Anne Boleyn, but he loved her nonetheless and was proud of her. Proud of her youthful beauty, proud above all of her formidable intelligence, which he recognized to be far greater than his own. She had accompanied him everywhere. In the jousts he had called himself Sir Loyal Heart and had worn her initials on his sleeve. On his return from his first campaign in France, he had ridden straight to her side and laid the keys of Terouan and Tournai at her feet. But by 1527 all that was long ago. He was still young and virile. She was 5 years older, putting on weight, though nowhere near as much as he was, and deeply, perhaps a little tiresomely, pious. We know of Bessie Blunt and the Duke of Richmond. We know, too, of Mary Boleyn, Anne's sister, who was also rumoured to have produced a son, though if she did, he was never acknowledged. On Anne's succession, she was unsurprisingly dismissed from the court, and then there was Anne herself. Madame Anne, wrote one of the Venetian emissaries, is not one of the handsomest women in the world. She is of middling stature, swarthy complexion, long neck, wide mouth, bosom not much raised, and in fact has nothing but the king's great appetite, and her eyes, which are black and beautiful. There was also the curious rudimentary sixth finger on her left hand, which induced many pious men and women surreptitiously to cross themselves to ward off the evil eye. But Anne also possessed enough intelligence to see that, if she simply gave herself to Henry, she would go the way of her sister and Mistress Blunt, and vanish into obscurity. Fortunately, there was an alternative. It was common knowledge that Henry was determined to dispense with Catherine, by whom he had now given up all hope of begetting a son. She had tried hard enough. Apart from several miscarriages, there were two boys and a girl who were either stillborn or lived for just a few hours, and another boy and girl who died after a week or two. Only Mary survived into adulthood. Divorce, or annulment, was in the air. Anne knew that if she played her cards with care, the throne might well be hers. She played them very well indeed, with a skill that she would all too soon have cause to regret, refusing all his entreaties and staying firmly clear of his bed. She was lucky, too, to have survived the sweating sickness which swept through London in the summer of 1528, bringing, as the French ambassador remarked, more business to the priests than to the doctors. She was desperately ill for several days. Had she died, the history of England over the last six centuries would have been radically different. Henry made no attempt to visit her. He had gone off like a shot to Hunsdon in Hertfordshire, hearing three masses a day, making daily confessions, and begging her, somewhat tactlessly, not to return to the court too soon. He also wrote to Wolsey, who had retreated only as far as Hampton Court, passing on medical advice and urging him to take care of himself. The cardinal must have been reassured by his master's solicitude. His last year had been one of increasing anxiety and fear. His worries had begun in 1527, when he had returned from France and found his admission to the king's chamber blocked, henceforth dependent on the will of Anne. In the following year, conscious now that he had lost much of the king's confidence and affection, he was still more uncertain where he stood. He had, however, one more important task to perform: to co-preside with Lorenzo Campeggio, Bishop of Salisbury, a Milanese he had been sent to England by Leo X in 1518 and had remained there ever since, over a Legantine court summoned by papal commission to meet in the Parliament chamber of the former Dominican priory at Blackfriars, with orders to settle the annulment problem once and for all. The court opened on the 18th of June 1529, and on the 21st, Henry and Catherine both gave evidence. See Shakespeare's Henry VIII, Act 2, Scene 4. It must have been an extraordinary spectacle. The king was fully enthroned under a canopy, the two judges, in full cardinalian fig, beneath him, and then, just a little lower, the queen. At their feet were the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Warham, and a whole bench of bishops. No one had ever seen anything like it before, a reigning king and queen appearing in their own land before a court summoned by an outside authority. In earlier years, Henry would never have considered such an appearance for a moment. But if it were now required to achieve the long-awaited annulment, then so be it. As far as he was concerned, nothing else mattered. Catherine spoke first. She had already appeared briefly 3 days before the court opened, protesting that it was hostile to her, the judges prejudiced. They were, too. Wolsey had been her enemy for years. Anyway, was not her case sub judice in Rome? If so, what precisely was this court doing? This time she struck a very different note. "Sir, I beseech you, for all the love that hath been between us, let me have justice and right. Take of me some pity and compassion. I take God and all the world to witness that I have been to you a true, humble and obedient wife, ever comfortable to your will and pleasure. I loved all those whom ye loved, only for your sake, whether I had cause or no, and whether they were my friends or my enemies. This 20 years or more I have been your true wife, and by me you have had divers children, though it hath pleased God to call them from this world. And when you had me at the first, I take God to be my judge, I was a true maid, without touch of man, and whether this be true or no, I put to your conscience. Therefore I humbly require you to spare me the extremity of this new court, and if you will not, to God I commit my cause." Whereupon, having made a deep reverence to the king, she left the hall. An usher tried to call her back, but she refused to listen. She had said what she needed to say. The court was hostile, she would have no more truck with it. In her absence, Bishop John Fisher of Rochester fought like a tiger on her behalf. All was reported straight back to Rome, where Pope Clement, realizing that his court could achieve nothing, was bitterly regretting having authorized it in the first place. On the 13th of July, he decided to bring it to an end, but already by this time proceedings at Blackfriars were in a hopeless state of confusion. A fortnight later, Wolsey reported that the hearing had deteriorated into a quagmire of insignificant disputes, and at the end of the month it fizzled out altogether. It was many weeks later that the papal instructions arrived calling for its abrogation, and summoning Henry to Rome. Henry had, of course, no intention of obeying the papal summons, but a full year went by without any developments, and by the summer of 1532 he was growing seriously impatient. It was now 5 years since he had revealed his intentions to Catherine, yet there she remained, still at his side, still the wife she had always been. He was also desperately regretting his treatment of Wolsey. The final blow had fallen in the autumn of 1529, only a few weeks after the Blackfriars fiasco. Wolsey had been arrested, charged, found guilty, and ordered to surrender the Great Seal. Later the king had released him, but had replaced him as Chancellor by Sir Thomas More. More had accepted the office only reluctantly. He was steadfast in the old Catholic faith, from which the king was rapidly departing. Moreover, he deeply disapproved of the divorce, though he was careful not to say so. After little more than 2 years, he resigned and retired from public life. Henry had promised not to molest him, but after he had refused to attend the royal wedding, he was arrested, found guilty of high treason, and sent to the Tower. He was beheaded on the 6th of July, 1535. Wolsey was effectively banished to Esher. Henry had already appropriated Hampton Court, where he and his household were without beds, sheets, tablecloths, cups and dishes, and where he had to beg money from his chaplains in order to pay his servants their wages. At this time he was informed that the king had also taken over his Westminster residence, York Place, despite the fact that it was technically not his property, but that of the Archbishopric of York. His only consolation was that he was still an archbishop, and in the spring of 1530 he rode off to the north, it was in fact the first time in his life that he had done so, intending presumably to spend his enforced retirement in his own diocese. Alas, there proved to be little retirement to spend. That autumn saw the issue of another warrant, this time on a charge of treason. The cardinal was said to have intrigued both in and out of the kingdom, and to have been guilty of presumptuous sinister practices made to the court of Rome for reducing the king to his former estates and dignity. On the 4th of November he was arrested while at dinner. Despairingly he started back to London to face trial and most probably execution. But these, fortunately, he was spared. He had got no further than Leicester when he was taken ill. He died there in the abbey, quietly, on the 29th of November. He was 57. Wolsey's downfall is generally attributed to his failure to secure the annulment of his master's marriage, but there were other reasons too. His relations with Anne Boleyn had been no better than they had been with Catherine, and in her conversations with the king, Anne had doubtless taken every opportunity to blacken his character, to question his loyalty, and to plant doubts in Henry's heart. Did the cardinal really care so much about the divorce? Was he really straining every sinew to obtain it? Nor was Anne his only enemy. Behind her was the aristocratic party at court, where the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk had always resented the pomp and ceremony with which Wolsey surrounded himself, and the arrogance with which the son of an Ipswich tradesman rode roughshod over the highest in the land. In pursuing his career, Wolsey had taken little trouble not to attract hostility, and Henry, always inclined to believe the last thing that was said to him, and with his judgment now still further clouded by his love for his betrothed, was himself curiously lacking in the loyalty that he demanded from everyone else. Seen in this light, Wolsey's fall was inevitable, and yet for Henry, after the dust had settled, he was a grievous loss. Among his many other strengths, for example, the cardinal had always known, nobody better, how to manage the curia. In an attempt to strengthen his support in Rome, Henry had tried to obtain a few red hats for his friends, but without Wolsey's help he had failed miserably. His agents had meanwhile combed the universities and monasteries of England and the continent for scholars and theologians, Greek and Hebrew, Christian and Jew, who would be willing to certify that his marriage to Catherine must indeed be annulled. But their countless testimonies had cut no ice in Rome. On the contrary, they had simply encouraged Catherine's champions to rally to her defence. Bishop Fisher wrote at least seven books and preached several sermons on her behalf. He was sent to the Tower in 1534, but in May 1535 Paul III made him a cardinal in the hope of securing his release. Alas, the Pope's gesture had the contrary effect. Henry forbade the cardinal's hat to be brought to England, declaring that he would send its owner's head to Rome instead. Fisher was executed on Tower Hill on the 22nd of June. The matter indeed seemed to have reached a stalemate, and the king had already decided, if the negotiations were to fail completely, to take the law into his own hands. Fortunately for him, there was a rising star in the political firmament who was rapidly taking over Wolsey's role. The son of a Putney blacksmith, Thomas Cromwell, was of origins humbler even than those of the cardinal. We know relatively little about his early life, except that he had somehow received a modicum of legal training, and that he had sat for some time in the House of Commons before joining Wolsey's household. Early in 1530, when he was already 44, he entered the royal service. 3 years later he was Henry's chief minister. Having lost his wife and two daughters in the sweating sickness epidemic, he had no family life, so far as we know, remarkably few friends, and, unlike his magnificent predecessor, no extravagances. He had thus some 14 or 15 hours a day to devote to his sovereign's interests. He was in power for only 7 years, compared with Wolsey's 15, but his achievement was far greater than the cardinal's. It was he who was to handle the eventual split from Rome, the establishment of the royal supremacy, the dissolution of the monasteries, and much else besides. An administrator of genius, he was also a superb publicist, the first in England to recognize and to make use of the immense power of the printing press, which William Caxton had introduced a couple of generations before. Cromwell was thus already in a position of considerable power when, in 1532, Henry decided that he must have another meeting with Francis. He was fully aware that behind the Pope's constant shilly-shallying over the annulment of his marriage to Catherine was the fear of offending her nephew the Emperor. Was it not just possible that the two kings together might succeed in persuading His Holiness to put aside this fear in the interests of keeping England in the Catholic fold? The idea was surely worth pursuing. In June 1532, the English and French governments signed a secret alliance, whereby it was agreed that Henry should cross the Channel the following October. Rather dashingly, he decided to take Anne, now Marquess of Pembroke in her own right, and therefore not Marchioness, with him. But there was a second reason for the visit, one that would have particular appeal for Francis. The Emperor's questionable position with regard to the Protestant princes in Germany. In January 1531, Charles's brother Ferdinand had been elected King of the Romans, and consequently heir to the Empire. Such an election during the lifetime of the reigning Emperor was unprecedented and, it was argued, unconstitutional, and those princes who had adopted Martin Luther's teachings were understandably alarmed by the election of a Catholic. In consequence, they had appealed to Francis for help. The king's own Catholicism was outweighed by the fact that he remained the Emperor's principal enemy, and at the end of February in the same year, 6 Protestant princes and 10 cities had formed a league in the town hall of Schmalkalden in Thuringia to protect their political and religious interests. 2 years earlier, at Cambrai, Francis had undertaken not to involve himself in German affairs, but the temptation to reply to the prince's appeal had been irresistible. He and Henry now needed to discuss what policy to follow in order to cause the Emperor maximum inconvenience. The third reason Henry took some care not to mention. Francis fascinated him. It was almost certainly a fascination tinged with more than a little jealousy. His mind often returned to the field of the cloth of gold 13 years before, when he had first been captivated by his fellow monarch. Since then he had never lost an opportunity of inquiring about him, his general appearance, his dress, his manner, his mistresses, and any other information he could gather. But, he insisted, this next meeting should in no way be a repetition of its predecessor. There must be no precious apparel of gold, nor embroidery, nor any other sort of nonsense. This would be an informal encounter between friends. His own retinue, he modestly added, would amount to no more than his personal household, plus 600 men-at-arms, together, of course, with the royal bed. The size and weight of this last item can well be imagined, but Henry never moved without it. It was agreed that Queen Eleanor should not be present at the meeting. As the Emperor's sister and Catherine of Aragon's niece, she might have been something of an embarrassment. Francis asked his sister Margaret, Duchess of Alençon, to do the honours in her place, but she flatly refused to meet the King of England's whore. Henry and Anne boarded HMS Swallow in the early hours of Friday, 11th of October 1532. The sea was mercifully calm, and they arrived at Calais in mid-morning. Deliberately or not, Francis kept them waiting, and for some considerable time. He arrived at Boulogne only on the 19th. The long-planned rendezvous thus finally took place on the morning of the 21st at what the French called Saint-Engelbert. The English, whose territory it was, did their best with Sandingfield. It was now 12 years since the two kings' last meeting, 12 years that had done neither of them any favours. Francis showed the effects of plenty of wine and women, but he was still only 38, and his passion for hunting kept him in moderately good physical shape. Henry, though only 3 years older, was already of formidable girth, and looked nearer 50 than 40. Both, however, were fit enough to gallop across a broad meadow to the meeting place, there to embrace each other while still in the saddle, and to ride hand in hand into the French territory of Boulogne, where they were greeted by a salute of, we are told, 1,000 guns. In spite of Henry's plea to go easy on the pomp and ceremony, Francis was clearly determined that this second meeting should not be too much of an anticlimax after the first. It would be tedious again to spell out in detail the whole programme, the daily masses, the banquets, the various sporting events, but no wrestling or jousting this time, the protagonists were too old for that sort of thing, and the endless exchanges of absurdly lavish presents that neither could afford. After 4 days, the party moved on to Calais, where Henry took his turn to be host. It was here that Francis first met Anne, to whom, despite the fact that she was already dripping with Catherine of Aragon's jewels, which, it need hardly be said, Catherine had surrendered with the greatest reluctance, on the first evening he sent a perfectly enormous diamond. The two seemed to have got on remarkably well, dancing together and chatting for over an hour on a window seat. The festivities ended on Tuesday, 29th of October, when Henry accompanied Francis on his 7-mile ride back to French soil. When in the past week the two had found time for serious discussions is not entirely clear. It had, however, been agreed that Francis would do everything he could to speed his friend's annulment. He professed himself to be very much in favour of the marriage to Anne. The two kings had pledged themselves to take up arms against the Turk, though in the years that followed neither of them was to show much inclination to do so. They had agreed, too, that something must be done about the Pope and the Emperor, who was known to be planning a return to Italy, which was bad news indeed for Francis. Finally, although at heart they probably disliked and certainly distrusted each other, they had shown the world, and especially the Pope and the Emperor, that they were brothers. There is no doubt that Henry felt the meeting to have been a success. It was only unfortunate that, just as he and Anne were about to re-embark, the weather closed in. Only after 12 days of storms and dense fog in the Channel were they able to return to Dover. Clement VII was by now seriously losing his grip. He seemed incapable of making any decisions about anything. In March 1532, the French ambassador reported that the Pope was so terrified of a Turkish invasion that he was seriously considering taking all the money he could lay hands on and bolting to Avignon, leaving Italy to look after itself. Francis and Henry had therefore resolved to make a formal approach to him by sending 2 high-powered French cardinals bearing firmly worded letters, Henry's about his annulment and Francis's about Italy, that left no doubt of the two monarchs' dissatisfaction and displeasure. The Pope was at that time once again in Bologna, and when the cardinals arrived in early January, they found the Emperor already there, busy discussing the possibility of holding a general council of the Church, the only way, he felt, of settling once and for all the problems posed by the Reformation. The cardinals were nevertheless given a surprisingly warm reception, and by the end of the month were able to report 2 major successes. The Pope had agreed to a meeting with Francis and, more significant still, had given his consent to the marriage between his niece, Catherine de' Medici, and the king's second son, the Duke of Orléans. Sultan Suleiman had felt a deep humiliation at his failure to capture Vienna. Determined on a second attempt, on the 25th of April, 1532, he once again left Istanbul with his Grand Vizier Ibrahim Pasha for a new campaign along and around the Danube. Behind him were some 100,000 men, including 12,000 Janissaries, dragging some 300 cannon. At Belgrade, another 15,000 were waiting, Crimean Tatars this time, put at his disposal by Giray their Khan. The Sultan somehow seems to have assumed that the Christian army, when he found it, would be led by Charles in person, for when the army reached Niš in Serbia and Ferdinand's envoys offered him 100,000 ducats if he would recognize their master as King of Hungary, he dismissed them with the words, "The King of Spain has long said that he wants to take on the Turks. By the grace of God I am now on my way to meet him with my army. If he is great of heart, let him await me on the field of battle, and let the will of God be done. If he has no desire to meet me, let him send a tribute to my imperial majesty." The army came to a halt on the 5th of August, when it reached Günz, a small fortress town some 60 miles from Vienna. It is now called Kőszeg, just over the Hungarian border. Suleiman had somehow been delayed on his march, and the army was temporarily under the command of Ibrahim. Put under siege, the Hungarian garrison of 800 men fought with enormous courage and determination, resisting 19 major attacks in 25 days. On the 6th day, the Grand Vizier called on its commander, Nicholas Juricic, to surrender and to pay an annual tribute of 2,000 florins. Juricic replied that he had no money. In any event, how could he be expected to surrender a castle that belonged not to him but to his master, the Archduke Ferdinand? So the fighting went on, and a contemporary reported, The Janissaries rushed forward and had already planted 8 standards on the walls. Protected only by the flimsiest defences and crushed against the walls, the inhabitants awaited their last hour. Then the old people, women and children, uttered a cry so pitiful and piercing that the attackers retreated in terror and even left 2 of their standards in the citizens' hands. This change of fortune occurred so suddenly and seemed so miraculous to both sides that the Turks believed they saw a heavenly knight brandishing a sword against them, and the Christians thought they recognized St. Martin, the doughty patron of Stein on the River Angers. An improbable account, to say the least, but so impressed was Ibrahim by the commander's courage that after a few more days he invited him under safe conduct to the Turkish camp, where Yuricic, who had by now lost half his men and was completely out of gunpowder, was only too pleased to accept the generous terms he was offered. The Grand Vizier treated him with elaborate courtesy, congratulated him and the entire garrison, and, though henceforth it would be in the Sultan's name, left him in command of the castle. It is a pleasant enough story, but Gunz was an unimportant little town, and its capture had cost a full month of fine campaigning weather. Was this why Suleiman, when he rejoined his army, decided to abandon his march on Vienna and to march instead into the region of Styria in southeast Austria? Vienna had been, after all, the object of his entire expedition. But then, if the delay at Gunz had indeed been responsible for the change of plan, would he not have shown at least some dissatisfaction with his Grand Vizier for wasting so much valuable time? There is no indication that he did anything of the kind. Another much likelier possibility suggested by his words at Nish is that he had somehow got it into his head that Charles was not far off with the Imperial Army. In such an event he might quite probably have decided on the tactic that had served him so well in the Mohacs campaign. First, to meet the enemy in pitched battle, and only after its destruction to advance on the capital. If so, he was disappointed. Charles was indeed on his way to Vienna, but he had no army with him. He certainly had no intention of meeting the Ottoman army in a battle that he might very probably lose. In fact, the Emperor was to arrive in Vienna on the 23rd of September. It was his first and only visit to the city, and was to stay there for only 10 days before moving on to meet Pope Clement at Bologna. Suleiman spent the month of September plundering and sacking as many Styrian towns as he could. Then he returned, via Belgrade, to his capital, which he reached on the 18th of November. The victory celebrations continued for 5 days, but must have rung a little hollow in his ears. This second expedition had been even less successful than the first. He had not even approached Vienna, far less attacked it. There would be no more attempts. The city, the one that he had longed more than any other to make his own, would remain in Christian hands. Perhaps it was in part due to the encouragement that he had received from Francis. Perhaps he had simply run out of patience. Whatever the reason, Henry married Anne Boleyn in a secret marriage service almost immediately after the return to Dover. Within a few weeks she was pregnant, and a second public ceremony was held on the 25th of January, 1533. On the 23rd of May, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, sitting in judgment at a special court convened at the Priory of St. Peter in Dunstable, declared the king's marriage to Catherine of Aragon null and void, on the grounds that her former marriage to Arthur had indeed been consummated, and a few days later pronounced that of Henry and Anne, whose condition could no longer be concealed, to be valid. Catherine was formally stripped of her title as queen. It was announced that as the widow of Prince Arthur, she would in future be known as the Princess Dowager. Her daughter Mary was declared illegitimate and thus placed outside the line of succession. The reaction of Pope Clement to this news may well be imagined. On the 11th of July he announced his formal condemnation of the king's marriage, threatening that unless Henry took back Catherine by September, he would be excommunicated. It is impossible not to feel sorry for poor Catherine. She had served both her native and her adopted countries well. The Venetian ambassador, Ludovico Falier, reported that she was more beloved by the islanders than any queen that had ever reigned. Her appointment in 1507 as the official plenipotentiary of the Kingdom of Spain to England had made her the first female ambassador in European history. Henry had appointed her regent, or governor of England, during his absence on campaign in 1513, and when the Scots invaded in September, she had ridden as far as Buckingham before she heard of their defeat at Flodden, despite being heavily pregnant at the time. Only a month after the victory, she had given birth to a stillborn son. Had she remained quietly in the palace, the whole of subsequent English history might have been different. She had genuinely loved her husband, and was to remain loyal to him for the rest of her days, claiming always to be his lawful wedded wife, and England's only rightful queen. For this reason, she had categorically refused Wolsey's repeated suggestions, which later turned to entreaties, that she should renounce her marriage and retreat to a nunnery. No, she said, that she could never do. She had come to Henry a virgin. God had called her to matrimony, not to monastic retreat. After her rejection, she went to live at the Moor, a palace in Hertfordshire. Not a trace remains, the French ambassador thought it more splendid than Hampton Court. From which she later moved, first to Buckton in Huntingdonshire, and then to Kimbolton Castle in Cambridgeshire, now a school, where she refused to leave her one small single room, and where, on the 7th of January 1536, she died. She was buried, by royal command, in the choir aisle of Peterborough Abbey, now the cathedral. She had suffered much, insults, humiliation, and, worst of all, the absence of her daughter Mary, whom for the last 5 years she had been forbidden by Henry, or more likely by Anne Boleyn, to see, to say nothing of the ever-present possibility of the scaffold. But her spirit and her serenity had remained unbroken. Even her enemy Cromwell confessed his admiration. Nature wronged the Queen in not making her a man, he remarked to the Emperor's ambassador, Eustace Chapwis, but for her sex she would have surpassed all the heroes of history. When the news of her death was brought to Henry, he characteristically dressed himself from head to foot in celebratory yellow, with a white feather in his cap, and celebrated with a ball and a banquet. But on the day of her funeral, Anne miscarried a son. It was Anne who now reigned supreme. Few queens of England, however, have been more unpopular. On the 29th of May, just a week after her marriage had been pronounced valid, she came by river from Greenwich to the Tower, with an escort of over 300 barges and smaller boats, all decorated with flags and banners. On the 31st she was carried on a litter through the city to Westminster, and on the 1st of June, it was Whit Sunday, she was crowned Queen of England by Archbishop Thomas Cranmer in the Abbey. Cranmer had been a fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge. He had been forced to resign on marriage, but after the death of his wife in childbirth, he had been reinstated and ordained. In 1532 he went to Germany as ambassador to Charles V. While there he married again, without resigning the priesthood. On all three occasions, it was noted, there were far fewer crowds than had been expected. She received little acclamation, where Catherine would have been cheered to the echo. A little over 3 months later, on the 7th of September, she gave birth to a daughter. Probably, writes Professor Scarisbrick, the most unwelcome royal daughter and most celebrated woman in English history. 3 days later, that daughter was christened Elizabeth, after Henry's mother, Elizabeth of York, with King Francis, naturally by proxy, and Cranmer standing as godfathers. Strangely enough, Henry himself, though present in the palace, does not seem to have attended the service. He is certainly not mentioned in Hall's very full account of it. Presumably he was reluctant to show his disappointment, which he would have been unable to conceal. Until Henry should produce a son, it was now Elizabeth who was heir to the throne. For Francis, too, 1533 was a memorable year, the year of the wedding of his own son to the Pope's niece, which Clement himself had promised to attend. On the 11th of October, the papal fleet of 60 ships dropped anchor at Marseille as the shore batteries cannonaded their welcome. On the following morning, the Pope entered the city in state, accompanied by 14 of his cardinals, all riding their mules. Francis himself arrived on the 13th, and on the 28th, in the church of Saint-Ferréol-les-Augustins, Clement VII officiated at the marriage of his niece, Catherine de' Medici, to Francis's son, Henry of Orléans. Both bride and groom were 14 years old. The wedding mass was interminable, and was followed by a sumptuous ball. Then at midnight, when both children must have been utterly exhausted, they were led to the bridal chamber, accompanied by Francis, who is said to have remained there until the marriage was properly consummated, afterwards reporting that each had shown valour in the joust. The next morning, while they were still in bed, they were visited by the Pope, who added his congratulations and blessings. It was, one feels, all they needed. Such a ceremony could have been interpreted only as a sign of a Franco-Papal alliance. But since no written treaty followed, it is impossible to say precisely what it was that Francis and Clement discussed during their many long conversations. The king would certainly have hammered away with his old obsession of Milan. Clement would have raised the time-honoured issue of Parma and Piacenza. Where Henry was concerned, we know that Francis asked for a further delay of 6 months before his threatened excommunication, but that Clement was prepared to concede only one. We also know that the Pope was left in no doubt as to Francis's feelings about the Turks, which he later reported to Charles. "Not only will I not oppose the invasion of Christendom by the Turk," the king allegedly declared, "but I will favour him as much as I can, in order the more easily to recover that which plainly belongs to me and my children, and has been usurped by the Emperor." Clement may also have questioned the good taste of the present he received from Francis on his departure. A unicorn's horn with the magic quality that if it were placed on a dining table, it would immediately signal the presence of poison in the food by breaking out into a sweat. As for King Henry, he was in a bit of a sweat himself. His rupture with Rome had made him a good deal more dependent on Francis than he had been before. On the other hand, Francis was now effectively the Pope's kinsman. How far could he still be trusted? Francis, fully aware of Henry's doubts, played on them to the full, and in 1533 he sent a new and particularly high-powered ambassador to London, a personal friend since childhood, Admiral Philippe de Chabot, Seigneur de Brion. The admiral brought with him a proposal, for nothing less than the marriage of Henry's daughter Mary to Francis's third son, the Duc d'Angoulême. The idea had originally come from Mary's former betrothed, the Emperor Charles, presumably in an attempt to console her for her recently declared illegitimacy. She was still recognised by the Pope, however, as Henry's lawful heir, so Charles was fairly confident that Francis would leap at the opportunity. Indeed, he almost certainly would have, had Henry been prepared to consider the possibility for a moment. He gave the ambassador a magnificent reception, lodging him in his own palace at Bridewell. But when Chabot told him of the proposal, his face clouded. The admiral, he said, must be joking. He would give Mary to Angoulême only on the condition that both he and she renounced all claims to the English throne. Failing that, he was prepared to offer the Duke the hand of his daughter Elizabeth and renounce his own claim to the throne of France if, but only if, Francis succeeded in persuading the Pope to lift the threat of excommunication that still lay upon him. Chabot, we are told, took no interest in either of these counter-proposals and returned to France much disgruntled. R. J. Knecht, Francis I, page 235. When Pope Clement returned to Rome at the end of the year, he was already a sick man, and on the 25th of September, 1534, he died. As supreme pontiff, he had not been a success. During the seemingly endless battle with Henry, he had consistently underplayed his hand. He might have thundered out anathemas, imposed excommunications rather than merely threatening them, encouraged those faithful to him to stand up against Henry, and promising them support. Instead, he had remained almost silent, terrified on the one hand of giving offence to the Emperor, on the other of taking too strong a line with the king, somehow always hoping that the whole thing would blow over. It was entirely typical of him that in 1532, when Anglo-Papal relations could hardly have been worse, he should have written to Henry asking his permission to send a papal librarian to England with the purpose of going through ecclesiastical and monastic libraries in search of books not yet in the Vatican collection. And yet, despite all his misfortunes, for many of which he had himself been responsible, he never forgot that he was a Medici and a Renaissance prince. He had been a patron of Cellini and Raphael, and it was he who commissioned Michelangelo to paint the Last Judgment on the east wall of the Sistine Chapel, as well as completing his work on the Medici tombs and the Basilica of San Lorenzo in Florence. Nor was the marriage of his niece to the future King of France his only dynastic triumph. In that same last year of his life, he also arranged for Alessandro de' Medici, at that time ruler of Florence, to marry Margaret of Austria, the natural daughter of Charles V. Alessandro was generally recognized as the only son, possibly by a Caribbean servant girl, of Lorenzo.